So it's September 20th, and this is a Pathwork teleconference on soul movements, of which I've selected five. And anybody who's willing, I'd love to go around and find out who's here and where you are calling from. And if you have any questions now, you're welcome to ask, or if you have them later at any time, you're welcome to ask. So this is Jan Rigsby, and I'm in Austin, Texas, and we did not suffer from the storm. It turned to the right and went up the center of the country, so peaceful here.
Hi, this is Wendy from Australia. I always have questions, but it's just you usually clarify them, so I'll leave it at that.
And I'd love to hear it, Wendy. It really helps me. One of the reasons I clarified is because I heard your question.
Oh, okay. Well, it's around Eros, and I think I'm getting an inkling of an understanding of why someone may not want to open up. But with there's a talk of if you want to sustain love in a relationship, you need to find the other as new and also continue to reveal yourself. So how does that work?
Yeah. So I'm going to say again, Wendy, that the reason I answer your questions without your having to ask them again is because you asked them in the first place.
Okay.
Cause and effect.
Good.
Very, very, very powerful. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
This is David from Australia. I'm in Paterson, New South Wales. Beautiful day here. And looking forward to the conference call.
Welcome, David.
This is Sonia, also from Paterson, New South Wales, Australia. And at the moment, I don't have any questions.
Welcome,
Sonia. It's Randall here from Australia, and I'm with David and Sonia in Paterson. Thank you.
New South Wales is well represented today.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, Randall.
This is Harry in Marshall, Texas. The storm did turn a little right, and it hit me just a little bit, but I'm all right now.
Oh,
no questions yet.
Okay. Glad you're safe, Harry.
Thanks.
All right, so like I say, if you want to interrupt at any point, please feel free. When I put out the notes for this teleconference, what I think I repeated a few times in my notes was, this is going to take us off the page. And by that I mean that a lot of times when you teach lectures, you can boil them down and make bullet points, and you can almost teach the lecture through the quotations. But on some subjects that the lecturers cover, the references are more nuanced than direct. So there are aspects of this work that you literally have to feel your way through. In using that phrase, I personally noticed, I'm going to call it a prejudice, I don't mean that negatively. Prejudice simply means prejudging. I've noticed a prejudice in pathwork and spiritual circles for feeling over other sensations, thoughts, feelings, dreams, eros, imagination, a preference for feelings. And that may be because as a Western civilization, we distanced ourselves for a while from feeling. So it may be like a return home to reintegrate feeling into our lives. But the guide actually speaks of many different aspects of spirit life and humanity that need to come along equally. So it's like you can't hoist up feeling above other things. You need feeling, you need thought, and then there are a lot of other things that help support feeling and thought. Even though those two are mentioned very, very frequently in the lectures. So the guide talks, when he talks about feeling, he talks about other support mechanisms. When the guide talks about Eros, he talks about support mechanisms, etc. So my calling here was to speak a little bit about five that I work with the most. I'm not trying to limit it, but five that I work with the most, to show interrelationships between them, to show how one really can't exist without the other. One of the quotations that I found that I put into the notes is about the dilemma of talking about this at all. Okay? So, this is taken from a Q&A, which is a question and answer session. I'll explain that in a moment. It happens to be number 76. It's listed on page 6 of the notes. Okay? And it's in two or three paragraphs in, and I'm just going to read it very quickly. The language in the spirit world is a picture language. When you are in the human state, accustomed to a completely different mode of expression, the symbolism of the pictures is something you have to translate. This, incidentally, is one of the reasons why it is so very hard for a spirit to express itself in human language. It is a limitation. Imagine it in the sense of translating a text from a foreign language. If you're not very familiar with that language and you have to translate the meaning into the language that is familiar to you, it will sometimes be a difficult, laborious task. It needs effort. Now, the punchline to that quote is the next sentence says, you have to think. And that's one of the places where I notice the guide isn't dependent upon any one means of human beings gaining consciousness and awareness. The guide says you have to feel, you have to think. The guide says you have to imagine. The guide says you need Eros. So there's more generosity here than an individual with an individual soul split and individual issues might see, because they might be drawn towards a certain healing that involved thought or feeling or even Eros. But from an overall picture, there's no one way to get there. So the reason I read that section is, if spirit is about an increased awareness, increased consciousness, and what we are bringing in is a picture language, then any time we speak of it, to some degree we are truncating the experience. You are making it smaller by asking it to fit into a word or a phrase. And a lot of what New Age spirituality is about is creating a container where we can sense into, to some degree, the original picture language. To some extent, it's about going back to the source material. And the source material is not in a book. It's not in a lecture. It's not even in human format. The source material is literally outside of our experience. So at another place in the lectures, the guide says that the spirit world is hugely multidimensional compared to the human experience. And the guide, I'm paraphrasing and making a joke out of it, but the guy almost says, I don't know how to tell you because it's very complicated and your language is so simple. But the truth in that, and I'm paraphrasing, but that was said by the guide, the truth in that is this, and that is that it is through what I'm calling these five examples of soul movement where we can sense back into the source material, which is rich and real and true, and continue to bring it forward into our lives. In other words, we have a capacity to replenish and refresh ourselves and our lives. But that pool is in a different dimension, and it's a pictorial language. And I'm sure that even that limits what it is. It's the guide's way of saying it's not spoken, but I'm sure it's not a snapshot album. So we add in our sensory experience of spirit, and this is what I'm referring to in terms of the soul movements. So that's why I wanted to leave this very, very loose, because this is not about the lectures. This is more about what the lectures are attempting to guide us to experience. The point of the lectures is not to solve our problems. What the guide wanted to do was help us in our experience of human life. And the phrase I keep coming up with over and over again is to increase awareness and consciousness. And the optimism in that is that if we increase awareness and consciousness, then we will find truth, we will find spirit, we will find God, we will open our hearts and be more of who we really are. So, of course, if you do not believe that that is true, if you believe that human beings are inherently bad, it would be natural for you to be afraid of an opening up. And this goes back to the original question you asked, Wendy. Why would someone not want to open up? Because of a fear that if they gave in to soul movements, something bad would happen. And looking at human culture and how we're raised and trained and programmed by certain cultural experiences, this is not an unusual belief to fear that if we truly opened up and became ourselves, it wouldn't be a good thing. That what we need is to cover up and be structured and be controlled by rules, because the inherent being in us is bad. So when you do this work, part of it is going back and finding what your beliefs are, because if your beliefs are that you're bad, you need to start working right there, because you will not open up if you believe that that will bring negativity into the world. Now, this gets complicated, and I understand that. There's a flip side to that. As you go under this layer by layer by layer, there would be a positive belief system even operating there. And that positive belief system would look like this. I believe I am bad, and I don't want to make the world worse. That would come from a higher place. Because if you were really bad, you wouldn't care. And if you were really bad, you'd want to spray negativity. Why not? The more the merrier. So oddly enough, even judging ourselves as bad and wanting to hide has a core belief of wanting to do good. Now, mentally, that may sometimes feel like a super double backflip, like on the acrobatic Olympics mat. And you listen to this and go, ow, that makes my head hurt. That's hard to imagine. So I'm going to go into these soul movements, and this is a segue to do that. Instead of trying to understand, see if you can be willing to simply sink down and accept that the very fact that you are on a telephone conference to hear about spirituality has a positive behind it. And what I am suggesting is simply trying indicates a longing, a wanting. Simply being present. You don't have to be present at something perfect. You can be present at something imperfect. It doesn't change your longing. When we search, it is the searching that I'm talking about. Where does that come from? From an inner longing of wanting to connect with truth. For an inner longing for a better life, for a happier life, for a more fulfilling life. And that's the positive, even under judgment. Even underneath a sense that the world is bad or that something is wrong. To know there is wrong, you must have some vague sense that there is a right and we're not there. And is that very small, very gentle sense that there is right and we're not there. And that's where soul movements begin to take, they come through in that place. So before I go any further, I've heard a couple of dings. If people would like to introduce themselves, they're welcome to. Otherwise, we'll go on. The vote is that we go on. Okay. So in terms of soul movement, there aren't very many references to soul movement, and yet they are mentioned without that word attached to them. Okay? But what is discussed when we discuss soul movement is that a soul movement is very, very soft. So when you are trying to figure out if something is a soul movement or a desire, a soul movement or a forcing current, is it eros or is it lust? Is it a feeling or is it an emotional reaction? When you look at this, even this takes some work. And it takes work to figure out whether it is soft and gentle or forced. And to do that, the guide says, you have to get acquainted with yourself. To attend to yourself. Examine yourself. And acquire the discipline to overcome the resistance, which is so difficult in the beginning. You have to observe all your notions about yourself which flatter you, with which it is so easy to deceive yourself. Then you have to cast them off or revise them. This work is something special, something different for each one of you, yet most of it is similar or can even be the same. When we talk about the spiritual progress of the human being, we mean something very individual for each one of you. And you, my dear ones, should search yourselves and ask, what hidden part of me still does not react according to the soul reality, the spiritual laws, even if only on a subtle inner level? Where do I lack clarity about certain things in myself? That quote is from Decisions and Tests, which is Pathwork Guide Lecture 2. So in the discussion of soul movements, one of the jobs of finding a soul movement, one of the things you have to do, is you have to look at yourself. This is a place where only you know if it's a soul movement or you're faking it. And if you have in the past deceived even your conscious mind, then you may be doing so again. So again, the phrase that I love in working with the lectures was the phrase, scrupulous honesty. This is hard work. This is, to some degree, turning yourself in. So what I want to do is I want to go to the soul movements that I have described, and I keep saying that because I don't want to limit your imagination. I don't want to pretend that these are the only ones. These seem major in pathwork. And for some of us, we have our favorites, and they're not listed. That doesn't mean it's not a soul movement. But I want to go through the five and flesh them out a little bit. And then I want to go into some experiential work where we can very softly and very gently demonstrate in your own mind, in your own, wherever you are sitting with your own telephone, examples of these soul movements. They are actually very, very easy to demonstrate, surprisingly so. But before I do that, I'd like to frame them just a little bit. So I don't know why, whether it was alphabetical or what, that I wound up with thought first. Perhaps it's because I'm a reason will type. That could be part of it. But on my pages, that came first. And the guide says, you know by now that all thoughts and feelings are forms of greatest reality, even if you cannot see them. And many, many times, I wish we were big enough where we could have lexicons and computer programs that told us how many times something happened, but the guide will rephrase things. So it's very hard to do a phrase search on some of these things. But after reading 100 or so lectures, you can start remembering that the guide has said dozens of times that every thought, every feeling actually creates a world in the spirit sphere. We can't see it, but that doesn't mean it's not true. And that when you create a positive, constructive thought, it has a great deal of power, even if you can't see it. And when you have a negative or destructive thought or feeling, it also has power, even though you may not have to take responsibility for it. It puts a world out in the spirit sphere, and that world will impact our earth plane. But there will be no smoking gun. There may not be any evidence whatsoever when you simply sit and fume at someone, or when you simply sit and think nasty thoughts. And you may think you can get away with that. What the lectures are saying is you do not get away with that. That you have created worlds, little tiny soap bubbles of worlds, and sent them out into the spirit sphere, carrying either your positive or your negative thought forms. And that these in spirit are just as real as any house you build or vehicle you drive or money that you give to charity. Another quote from the guide says that your thoughts are reality. They have form and substance. And by unclean thoughts, you build disharmonious forms, which must eventually have their effect in your lives and destinies. However, not only thoughts can have this effect, but also feelings, emotional reactions, or subconscious thoughts. Now, that's unfair. That's terrible. Because if you can't sense into what your subconscious is, or unconscious, which is the definition of the thing in the first place, if you can't sense what you're thinking or feeling unconsciously, how can you possibly take responsibility for them? So in pathwork, what we teach is that that's your job, to uncover them. That staying ignorant is a conscious decision. That if you look, you will find. And therefore, the very act of working to discover what your unconscious thoughts and feelings are is a positive, constructive act. So the guide specifically pulls up the idea of thought when he talks about prayer. So thought is mentioned a great deal in Pathwork Guide Lecture 5, Prayers and Meditation, and also in The Call, Lecture 17, which is called The Call - Daily Review. And what the guide says is, this is from Lecture 17, these thoughts add to the cosmic reservoir and flow in the universe so that the forces of good become that much stronger compared to the forces of evil. So what is thought? I did not find the quote, but at some point the guide says that a thought is an unfelt feeling. Thought is not thinking. Thought is not intellect. It is not argument or justification. A thought in your mind, similar to a feeling, can feel like a little shooting star. By the time you notice it, it's gone. And this is the level of thought that we refer to in terms of soul movement. And what you can do is you can gather your thoughts into thinking. And that sometimes what prayer is a thinking process, a way of gathering these thoughts and creating a structure with them that becomes a prayer that is offered. And this is how the guide says this is the power of prayer, if it is clean, if it is pure. So I was just trying to give some different aspects to thought, because sometimes that can be dismissed as intellect. And in Western civilization, we have a great deal of intellectual capacity, and that can get confused with the more simpler version of thought. Are there any questions? Okay. The next one for the sequence, and once again, I don't know why this sequence happened. The next one is feeling. Now, when I researched thought, I used the link. There's a link to a pathworker in Belgium who put all the lectures online and did a word search, however you do all these things. And thought, for instance, wound up being mentioned 555 times. Feelings, in the term of the four-letter word feel, wound up being discussed 4,893 times. So the guide spends a lot more time on feeling than he does on thought. And perhaps that is because we get in trouble with thought. It turns so easily into thinking and intellectualization. So referring to feelings now, the guide does say that, and this comes from Lecture 7, The Sea of Life, the most difficult task is on the emotional level. This is the highest level, because first of all, many feelings are unconscious, and you need work, willpower, and patience to make them conscious. Interestingly, the next thing he says is the next stage is to cultivate one's thoughts. Another aspect of feelings, and this is going to sound a little backwards, is from Lecture 13 on Positive Thinking, the guide says, truth must always make you happy, even unpleasant truth. Now that sounds like a paradox. Paradox is an apparent contradiction. It isn't a contradiction, but it sounds like it. So how can unpleasant truth make you happy? And what the guide says is, deep down, your higher self always has the correct answer, and you must feel it. Thus, truth will never depress you. So what I'm speaking of here is that feelings, when the guide is talking about them, do not have an inherent positive or negative bias. The guide does not differentiate between bad feelings are bad and good feelings are good, because as far as the guide is concerned, bad feelings are labeled that because it makes us feel uncomfortable. But what if you need to feel uncomfortable? What if that's what your soul needs? You may still keep the label uncomfortable or unpleasant. And yet, if those feelings are what you need to create movement inside you, then they're good. Using good as gaining ground, going closer to spirit, you know, all these things that we say we want. So what I'm differentiating here is that feelings per se are simply a primary soul movement. They indicate a truth. The trick is that thoughts and feelings are so fragile, and they are not invested in an answer. And they can be shanghaied. They can be hijacked. So you can have a feeling, and if you slap a label on it, you may actually destroy the purpose of the feeling. The feeling may come up to create a little discomfort, to shift you in your life. And you label it bad and shove it away, and there goes the discomfort. On the other hand, if you have a feeling of pleasure and goodness, and you accentuate that feeling, if you hype it up, it's not really the original simple feeling anymore. It's a bigger thing. It becomes a drama. It becomes an exaggeration. And it doesn't actually carry the truth. There is truth in the degree of our feelings. A feeling that you like someone is different than if you have a feeling that you love them. And that distinction and delineation carries grains of truth. It's important for you to understand your true feelings. So if you hype up, I like someone, into I love someone, on some level, you've destroyed the truth. And now you're dealing with a construct, with an image. So both thoughts and feelings, the work is to find out what the real thoughts and feelings are. So the next item on the list was Eros. I could do hours on Eros. I could do a whole workshop on Eros. I love Eros. And so for Eros, I'm going to again read a quote, because the guide's words are hard to improve upon. Eros is the nearest thing to love the undeveloped spirit can experience. It lifts the soul out of her sluggishness, out of mere contentment and vegetation. It causes the soul to surge up, to go out of itself. when this force comes upon the most undeveloped person, he will become able to surpass himself. Even a criminal will feel temporarily, at least towards that one person, a goodness he has never known. The utterly selfish person will, while this feeling lasts, have unselfish impulses. The lazy person will get out of his inertia. The beautiful part of the lecture, I recommend that you read it. I don't want to go on with the quotes. But this is, of course, why it is one of the most powerful soul movements. Because while thoughts and feelings can be like little shooting stars going back and forth, Eros is a volcano. Eros is an earthquake. Eros lifts you up and flings you across the room before you know what hit you. Eros may be a soul movement, but it is a powerful one. And I teach Eros not in the erotic or love sense, but I teach in the sense that Eros can happen anytime for anything. That it has a universal capacity to go where it needs to go. And any time you pick up and pull yourself up and move in a giant manner towards any idea or purpose or person or situation, you're probably in the grips of Eros. I mean that if it's clean and pure, not thought out and not justified and not some kind of scheme, but something that simply erupts within you. So again, as a quote, and when Eros comes to you, it will lift you up far enough so that you will sense and know what is in you that longs for this experience and what it is that your true self, which is longing to reveal itself. So, in answer to the question originally asked, why would someone deny Eros? Again, what if you thought that when you ripped the cover off, the thing inside was stinky? What if you thought that if you revealed yourself to someone, they would curl their nose up in disdain? And either rightly or wrongly, because it really doesn't matter too much, reject you and point out your flaws. This would dampen Eros. Eros is truly driven by the belief that we deserve love. We deserve happiness. We deserve pleasure. And I think that's the meaning of the guide saying, even a criminal. So there is a place where, I think it's more, I don't know whether it's culturally based or not, so please forgive the example. But there's a place where criminals aren't supposed to have fun while they're in jail. And the idea of a prisoner having fun, some people really get upset about that. Because they imagine that a human being can spend 24/7 in misery. And that's supposed to happen because, after all, they were bad, and that's how they got put in prison in the first place. People don't live like that. People find enjoyment and pleasure, companionship, communication, and connection wherever they are, under any circumstances, because you really can't live without it. So imagine that even a criminal might find, in the depths of prison or in his escape or whatever, might find something that made their heart sing. To some degree, that is their redemption. That's the only thing that will ever be able to redeem them and bring them back into clean contact with people, that desire to connect. It is the most wonderful thing. And so we have a contradiction here, or push-pull. The biblical reference would be to the prodigal son. which I spent a whole afternoon teaching on the prodigal son one time, where, and I did this because I have a problem. When I was a kid, I had a problem with this no good person coming back and getting fed. You ran away, you squandered your money, I stayed home, I washed the dishes. You shouldn't be able to come back and be my equal. And that, while that is a natural human reaction, look at it from the point of view of Eros. That someone who went away and who went down roads that they now regret wants to come home. If you make it very, very difficult and very, very painful, they might veer off in a different direction. And yet there was a place that I now, as a more mature person, where I appreciate the point of view of the Father saying, come home. Come home, I love you. It's not about equality or fairness. It's about the truth. I want my son to come home. We'll work out the details later. This would be a place of Eros speaking instead of judgment or thinking or construct. So the next soul movement is dreams. Dreams are tricky. The guide says dreams are tricky. Some of the dream information is found in odd pieces of information, question and answers, and guide does not talk about it as directly as perhaps some other things. But one of the things the guide says about dreams is the dream always contains a special message to you from your own soul. Your own dreams are messages of love, although they sometimes reveal something to you that at first you do not want to know. The true message that comes from your soul is instructive rather than flattering. That kind of message is from the real spirit world. And that quote is from Laziness and Self-Alienation, Patrick Guide 96. What the guide presents about dreams is that when we dream, truly dream, instead of daydream, when we truly dream, we actually, it's like falling through back into the spirit world and getting some instruction. Going home. Plugging in. And then when we come back through the portal and we come into the conscious human world, we carry, as I said before, pictorial language. But the pictorial language is multidimensional, and we only have three or four to deal with here. So that's one of the reasons why dreams may not seem to make sense. They make perfect sense in the spirit world. But that's not where you are when you're trying to remember them. You are already back inside human consciousness. So what I am saying here is that true dreams, the real fragments, not the stories we make out of them, but the little pieces of tissue paper dream that we don't interpret and mangle, are scrapbook items from time we spend in the spirit world. They are about our soul. They are messages from us to ourselves. And since the game is that the world is perfect, there must be a reason why we don't have a direct intravenous line to the spirit world. There must be a reason why this transmission of information is veiled and fragmented and softened. So one way of saying that would be that if the world is a laboratory and we're here to learn something, of course we don't have the instruction manual. What would be the point? But we are given clues. And when I teach soul movements, what I'm teaching is these are your clues. Like a detective picking up forensic information, this is the evidence of your own soul. But you have to watch out and not get in your own way. You need to not step on the evidence and then interpret the mangled bits as real. No, they're mangled. You're going to have to start over sometimes. Sometimes you may get a message and you've muffed it so badly that you're going to have to go back and get another message. You're going to have patience. You're going to have to understand that maybe the teaching was you should have left that alone. Now it's all messed up. We'll give you another one tomorrow. Don't worry about it. Instead of getting all wrapped up and upset that you can't understand something anymore. So an example of that would be to take the fragments of a dream and try to weave them together, like trying to baste an old sock together and weaving a line back and forth, trying to pick up all the different threads, instead of leaving it alone and noticing what the whole looks like, what the threads look like, before going in and trying to make it make sense. So once something is repaired, once you've dabbed it up with stucco or spackling plaster, it's hard to remember what the original looked like. And so sometimes we need to pause and wait for another example to come forward. So I'm speaking of the part of dreams that are soul movements in the sense that they are information from you to yourself. And they do require a gentle, loving patience and acceptance for you to get what they mean. So the last one is imagination. And when I was a kid, I remember the phrase, "That's only your imagination." And a lot of other negative comments that basically said, if it's not real, it doesn't count. And yet, when the guide talks about imagination, he says imaginary outlets are necessary. That it's not an accident that humans have imagination. It's part of our construct. As spiritual beings, we wouldn't have imagination if we weren't supposed to use it. Now, when you have something, you can misuse it. If you have a car, you can hit posts, you can hit small children, or you can get to work on time. It's a matter of what you use it for. So the guide talks in terms not of imagination very often, but what is it without it? And he says in Wishful Daydreams, he says, "For what is lack of imagination? It may mean that your creative faculties are inhibited. Not having conscious daydreams may also indicate resignation and stagnation." In another lecture, Mutuality 185, he says, "This synthesis of creativity, imagination, ideas on the one hand and execution on the other must take place." So he's describing mutuality. With creativity, imagination, and ideas and execution merging together. And the last quote I want to make is from Dynamics of Movement, Lecture 241. And it says, "If you cannot perceive it at all as a possibility, you cannot experience it." If you cannot perceive it at all, you cannot experience it. There was recently a little film documentary called What the Bleep, and they brought forward something that I'd heard of in other situations. And that is that the South American, I think it was the South American Indians, when they saw the ships come into the harbor, the natural harbor, they'd never seen a ship before. And so they didn't see it. And then these men appeared on the shore, and the Indians didn't know where the men had come from, because they really hadn't seen the ship. It's cognitive dissonance. It's a you can explain it psychologically, but basically, when they saw the thing on the water, they had no context. They didn't know what it was, and they couldn't imagine a ship coming from a foreign shore, etc., etc. So they didn't see it. And if you don't see a ship, you don't imagine men being on the ship and then coming ashore. So when the men came ashore, they were surprised. Where'd the men come from? You use imagination every day of your life. You may not call it that, but it is. You are imagining what is possible. And it helps flesh out the possibility so you can go there. So imagination is like an advance team, staking it out and figuring out what might be so that you can then step in to new possibilities. Are there any questions at all?